there was a night, with the exception of when I used to work at the care home many years ago, with the exception of that, I haven't seen grown men become as emotional as they do, as when they come up and speak to me, either expressing their joy at what the Dhamma has done for them, or the humble invitation that they make to deliver the Dhamma and help them seek their deliverance from suffering. It's quite something. When I was at the care home, I have seen grown men become very emotional when they felt that they were helpless and they were destitute, no one to care for them. I've shared some of those stories with you. But here it's a different thing altogether. These are tears of joy. Your eyes well up. It's when you recognize that only at the Buddha's feet, only in the Sangha's embrace, do we find true happiness, freedom and joy. That speaks volumes to me. There are occasions when you come and try and express your gratitude, but you just can't find the words, or you just become too emotional to get the words out of your system. Swami Mahansa are the only two words that you can spit out, and after that you are a mess. So in those instances, I just give you a pat on the back and say, yes, I understand, sir. You have said it all. For ladies, you know, becoming emotional is just part and parcel of who you are, right? Nothing to write home about that. But, you know, when a grown man becomes emotional, there's a world of emotions going on inside of him. Like I said the other day, you mustn't make a father cry. Certainly not tears of sorrow. But it's breathtaking when a grown man comes to tears out of sheer devotion. Honor, respect, piety, obeisance to the Buddha, Dhamma and the Sangha, and the heartfelt invitation they make to the Mahasangha, that speaks volumes. It is a testimony to the transformation that has happened within them. This is something I truly value about the Rajagirian community. You're not just here for the show. You're not here just because it's Sunday and you've got nothing better to do. You're here for change. Not to change the others. Not to change the rest of the world. Not to change your neighbors or your relations. You're here because you recognize that change must happen within. And I truly respect and admire that, ladies and gentlemen. It is what makes it coming here week on week worth it. And it's not in your words, I can see it in your actions. I can see it in the way that you look after each other. The unity that you have to one another. And the joy that you strive to place in each other's hearts, the love, affection, with which, although the Swami Mahansa's words can bring people here, they can't keep them here for very long. For that they must see and experience and witness the change that the Dhamma has made the impact of the Dhamma. That is not to be seen in Swaminarayan Sei's words. And this step into robes is a big leap for many. Yeah, that's a huge leap. A leap that many can't even fathom. For many, it's almost a miracle how one could ever take that leap. But to become someone like you, from someone like them, oh, that's well within their means. And that seems a lot more possible, achievable, feasible. That's why I say, what you are to one another and how you are with one another is the true testimony of this teaching. And I really admire that. That's the greatest pirikara that you can ever offer to me. What you have become. Because that is priceless. Who you have become is priceless. Many of you are here because of many of you. I never did the sermons. I never went to your homes, gave you a lift here, held you by your hand when you were about to leave and said, stay for another 5 minutes. I didn't do that. Most of the time I just say things to hurt your feelings. Is it not a surprise that many of you are still here? 2.5 years on? That's how many? Three? Three going four? Ah, last week three. Ah. Time flies when you're having fun. I didn't realize that it's been 3 years now. So we are 3 years younger. So 3rd year anniversary last week then. Okay. Well, I have some gifts to offer to you today. There was unusually heavy traffic this morning. I wondered why. Then I realized that the word must have got out that they are going to be precepted properly for once. This is the good pansil this week. You get the regular pansil every other week. This week you are going to get good pansil from the latest addition to our monastic family. We have a new arrival. A new 15 new babies were born yesterday. 15 Gandhabbas descended into the monastic mother's wombs with new parents. As the old parents handed them over to their new parents, and I have brought along with me one of them. Next week I'll bring another one. Because there's so much they want to share with you. They have a lot of gratitude that they would like to share with you, to express to you. Another something I really admire. The fact that once you become a monk, it's a request they make. Can I go back and talk to the community, these people who helped me become who I am today? Says so much not only about them but also about you. Why it is that they like to come back and speak to you. So I always tell them, leave some time for me as well. So then, today to precept you, which is a privilege and honor that I always have, I would like to most respectfully invite who used to be the almost venerable Ramesh Ratnayake. Now he's the most venerable. Panadure Rahulananda Thero. All the way from Nairobi, Kenya. Born in Sri Lanka. Made in Nairobi. killed in Ingria. And then born again. Please come up to the dais. You know what he practically called you, all right? No? And then you thought I was critical. Maiden sermon, and what a strike. Both him and his wife are very, very affectionate people, very loving, very gentle, soft-spoken. The real kind of characters that we want. Very easy to give them the Dhamma. They're very soft individuals inside. Which is partly the reason I think you must have got along really well with him when he used to drive the monks to Rajagiriya and also welcome you all when you visited the monastery. But they lived a very successful life in many ways. As you heard some of his story. A lot of the things that most people can only dream of. These are dreams in the minds of young people, traveling the world, going places, having nice food, enjoying themselves, right? Getting married, settling down, then traveling together. These are the dreams that fill young people's hearts and minds. So to have been there and then to have come across a teaching, because they never felt fulfilled. Like you said, I was always searching for something. And despite everything that had come their way, despite all the pleasures that they had experienced, he was never fulfilled. And this is the truth, ladies and gentlemen. You will also encounter this realization at some point in your lives, if you haven't already. And you must. This is the moment where your understanding ripens and becomes wisdom. If it's happened for you, then the only reason you're not where he is either because of some obligations and duties and responsibilities, like we talked about last week, or the stars haven't aligned yet for you. But generally speaking, if that moment has come to you in your lives, where you have come to this realization that although there is all these things, there are all these things, but I'm just not fulfilled, then you keep looking for something. And then eventually when you find that one thing that fills you, if at that moment you still don't feel fulfilled, then, you know, either you don't have the wisdom to understand the Buddha's teaching, or if you have, then it's only a short matter of time before you make that shift in your lives. And this is one example of how that has happened. Or rather, two examples. And of course, there are plenty more. Plenty more. But I want that day to come for all of you, sooner rather than later. Because the sooner you come to that realization, the more time you have left to do finally something that is worthwhile doing. Let's be honest, right? Everything else you do until that point is going to be a waste of time. Frankly speaking, let's be honest. Everything else you do until that point is going to be a waste of time. Because it just keeps you going round and round and round in this loop. Yeah? You can do merit, yes, that's good. And then you come back to reap the fruit of that merit. While you're reaping the fruit of your merit, if you don't do more merits, you will just consume all of it and it expires. Because merit is also anicca. Once you use it, it's used, it's gone. You can't use the same merit twice. It's like, these are like tissue papers or cotton buds. How many times can you stick one in your ear, which you're not supposed to do, apparently, doctors say. But how many times can you use a cotton bud? Once. Merits are single use. How many times can you use a single use item? Is it not obvious? There you go then. It's once. It's a single use. So the moment you use up a merit, that's it. You've used it. So if you want another one, what must you do? You've got to do another one. So it always requires effort on your side. I mean, merit is good. I'm always on the side of merit. I admire merit. Guru Hamdra always goes on about merit, and now we must all be doing merits like it's going out of fashion. Right? He's always talking about it. But let's be honest with each other. It requires a lot of effort, either mentally or physically, right? If to do the actual act of merit, it takes a lot of effort. You know, to build a school, it takes a lot of effort. To teach at a school, it takes a lot of effort. To give one of these sermons, I'm exhausted by the end of this talk. You should see me in the resting area. These our Mahatyas, they quickly bring that Gilam Pasad, because the moment I'm back in that room and I've used the washroom, I'm yawning my guts out. Simply because I'm totally just exhausted. Because we don't reserve any of whatever energy comes my way. None of it is reserved. This is total release. So that I can reach as far and as many of you as possible. All of us are like that. Nothing unique about me. By the end of this, ask Sudasihandru. Actually, no point asking him, because both of us are knackered on the way back to the monastery. The Swami once wakes us up. Sorry, the Anagarika Mahatya wakes us up by the time. Or when we get to the monastery, says, Swaminasa, we are there. Because there's no energy left at the end of one of these. It's not easy. And for those who do sermons in other languages, they have to learn the languages. That's not easy. Is learning a language easy? No, it's a lot of hard work. Setting this up, you think this is easy? Doing these videos? None of it is easy. So it's all merit. I understand how much I need merit, therefore I'm more than happy to do it. Not only for merits, but also it gives you something. But I still understand that it is also simply a means to an end. Although I do merits, I'm not in love with merits. I want you to understand the same. Let's do merits, but let's not fall in love with them. Such that we come to the point where let's just keep living and doing merits till the end of time. That's not what we are here for. Because it requires a lot of effort. It's tiring. You have to overcome many hurdles, many challenges. And you know, when you want to get together and do something as a group, sometimes it's like walking on eggshells, isn't it? Some communities are better than others, but sometimes it can be like that. You could be very careful not to say the wrong thing at the wrong time. Always be mindful about how others might receive the message that you want to give, even though you give it with the best of intentions. I mean, a family is the same. You know, what more can be said about any other community or group of people? So it's all very energy consuming. Therefore, what I really want is to bring an end to all of this. To put a stop, final full stop. And for that, I do merits. For that, we must all do merits. But unless you make that transformation within you, ladies and gentlemen, and really fall in love with Nibbana, which is the ultimate destination, this is just this non-stop loop. We just keep going round and round and round and round in circles. Whatever educational qualifications you've had by now, you have achieved by now, this is not the first time you've achieved them. You've done it countless times. So every one of you is a PhD holder. Every one of you is a professor. Every one of you is an astronaut, is an engineer, is a scientist, is a doctor, is an everything. You just can't remember it. Therefore, you have to start all of it again. If I gave you a piece of cloth, right, and a bowl of muddy water, and I asked you to first wash that piece of cloth and drop it in the mud, and soon after you've done that, I said, come on, wash it again. And soon after you've done that, I say, okay, put it in the mud again. And I say, okay, right, take it back out and wash it again. And then I say, put it back in the mud again. You won't do it the third time. Let's be honest. You won't do it the third time. Not for lack of obedience, but you will question the point of doing it. Yes or no? You will ask, Swami, no, so what's the point of doing this? I've done this three times already. Why do you keep asking me to do something that seems pointless? Will you or will you not? Then, it's the same can be said about sansara. So what we do when we do merits is we just take that dirty piece of cloth and we wash it. In water, soap, we wash it. Merit is that. What is demerit? Put it back in the mud. So it's either in your hands under the tap or it's in the bowl with the mud. It's one of these two states. But there's one thing you can do, which is wash it, put it out to dry, and then put it in the drawer. So it doesn't get back in the mud again. But you can't put it in the drawer while it's still muddy. You've got to wash it first. But wash it and dry it and put in the drawer, not put back it in the mud. But what do most people do? They just put it back in the mud. This is sansara. Good and bad. Good and bad. The devil and the demon. That's what sansara is. No, they're both the same, right? Not the devil and the demon. The devils and the angels. Angels and demons. That might be copyright, actually. I don't know. But I don't want you to be just stuck at being an angel. There's one step beyond that. You can become God. Don't limit yourself to being angels. You can become God. God is above all that. Above both demons and angels. When you get to God's state, you're peerless. Unparalleled. There's no match. God doesn't become an angel again. Never does he become a demon or the devil. Right? So that is what I want you to aim for. Become God. Try and find an escape out of this loop. For that, you just need to do what Swaminarayan said happened in his life. He went looking for something. And remember how he convinced his parents that this is what he wanted to do? Yeah, he convinced his parents that no matter what he has, he's never happy. That's what you need to do as well, ladies and gentlemen. Don't mean about your parents. Initially, you must be convinced before you start talking to your parents. Maybe your parents are more than happy to give you up, but you're not ready yet. So listen to the Dhamma so you can understand this truth. First of all, I want you to realize that this incessant loop that you're stuck in doesn't take you anywhere. It's a loop, like the hamster wheel. Just keep running round and round and round and round. There's no coming out of it. Like that donkey behind the carrot. This is a perfect analogy. I can't give you one better than that. Why is it so successful, this donkey behind the carrot business? Because there's always the promise of it, but never achieving it. That's why it's successful. Because the moment the donkey actually eats the carrot, what do you think is going to happen? It'll stop. If the donkey is ever able to eat the carrot, the donkey will stop because there's no longer an incentive to keep moving forward. So why does the donkey keep moving forward? Because there's only the promise of it. It's dangling in front of its eyes. It can smell the the carrot, it's almost, you know, on the tip of its mouth, almost. That's what keeps the donkey going forward, moving forward. And that way, the donkey never stops. So what do you call those who just keep going forward for the promise of something, but never achieving it? Huh? I'll give you a hint, it starts with D. Dharmishta? I said, it starts with D. What were you thinking? Now we just want you to come out of this, ladies and gentlemen, that's all. That's all. That's what Swaminathan wants, that's what I want, that's what Guru Handra wants. That's what all noble companions want for you. This is within your reach. Because you can do it. If you can't do it, I won't be talking to you like this. We wouldn't be trying to, you know, get you to jump on a bandwagon if this was not for you and if it was not possible for you. You know, to send you just down a rabbit hole, I wouldn't do that. What would be the point? This is possible for you. This is possible for every one of you. There are many among you who don't have to remain in lay lives. There are many among you who don't have to, but you choose to. Why do you choose to? Because you still have some gap in your knowledge, in your understanding. That's why. That's what I try and come and fill week on week. There's some gap in your understanding, somewhere where it still doesn't make sense, it doesn't all add up. Guru Handra always says this when he speaks to our devotees. He says, Pingutani, you are still in this audience because you still haven't understood what I'm trying to tell you, what I'm trying to teach you. Because if you have understood this, you will not remain where you are. The lure of whatever it is that you're after is only there because you don't understand this. The moment you realize that this is only a mental phantom, then you wake up. It just becomes a dream. After you wake up, you don't go chasing dreams, do you? Once you've woken up, you're awake. You don't go chasing dreams. But while you're in your dream, it seems very, very real. So our effort is to try and wake as many of you up as possible while we can. One of you recently came and spoke to me and said, Swaminathan, sir, I'm now just above 40. I have a very real fear that the sasana will expire before I do. If I don't come now, then every year I delay this, that's another year out of the time that I have left to practice. And then if I die, I have no idea where I might be born. And if I'm born somewhere where there is no sasana, then this will be the end. So this might be the first and last chance that I get. If I don't use it now, then what promise, what hope is there that will be there with me forever? I said, very true. Very true, you've hit the nail on the head. That's exactly what I'm talking about. You know, the only reason that... Can I ask you a question? If tomorrow you fell unconscious, they took you to the hospital, the doctor did some scans, and he said, you have 2 years left. Right? What's your next stop? If the doctor told you have only 2 years left, what's your next stop? Oh, Disney World. You know where it is. So the only reason that you're not there now, not there yet, is because you have given yourself a lease that has no expiry date. Right? You think that lease doesn't expire. You know it does, but you live with this false sense of confidence that it must be a very long time. Right? If I ask you who here is going to be dead in the next 2 years, give me a show of hands. See? No one. None of you think that you're going to be dead in the next 2 years. So if I shorten the time even more, said 1 year? Of course not. If not in 2 years, how can it happen in 1 year, Swami answered. So you have this false sense of confidence that you will outlive everyone else in this room, I think. You still feel that you have plenty of time. That's a feeling that you have. It's difficult to kick that feeling off. That's what jati does. It is also jati that does that to you. When jati happens in the mind, it forecasts the present to the future. Whatever your present is, it forecasts to the future. He says, I'm healthy now, so I will be healthy in the future as well. Jati does that because it does not let you accept everything as pachupanna. Whereas the truth is, right now, you're consuming your merits. Once that merit, quantity of merits run out, once your tank of merits runs out, that's it, the vehicle stops. Not tomorrow, not the day after, instantly. So you are at the mercy of your merits, ladies and gentlemen. You really need to understand that. I will try to convince you more and more. Every week I will try to convince you and take you forward in your wisdom, in your understanding. Right? But I want you to open your hearts up, open your minds up and be receptive to this message. Don't just show up. Be here. Really be here. Really understand why Swami Nuances make this much of an effort to try and save you. This is a salvage operation. I'm trying to salvage as many of you as possible. Because this is already a disaster. The fact that we are in samsara is a disaster. That's it. So now what we can do is salvage as many of you as possible. This is what my teachers did with me. I was already a disaster. I look at your faces and I see possibility. That's what I really honestly see. I see possibility. In each of your faces, I see possibility. The possibility of salvation. I can look at each and every one of you in the eyes and tell you, I see possibility. It's possible. I can show you how. Then you need to take that step. I don't always mean come to ropes. But for those who can, why not? See? He said, you know, in the conventional sense, he lived a very happy married life. And good for him and his wife. But why is she an anagarika today? Why is it when she had such a loving husband? You know what a gentleman this Swami Nuhansi is, right? Gentle monk. Used to be gentleman. No, you've spoken with him, you've spent time with him. So imagine what he must have been like as a husband. How kind he must have been to his wife. How caring he must have been. So to have had a husband like that and yet come to the sasana, why? Why do you think that is? Think, ladies and gentlemen, these are the things I want. This is why I bring them here. I'll try and bring her one day as well. So you can hear her side of the story. You've not heard that, have you? Because you don't get to spend time a lot talking to our Anagarika Mahatmyas. The Mahatma ladies do, but not always the gents. But I want you to hear that story as well. What is it that she lacked? Opportunities? No, she had all of that. A good husband? No, she had that. Loving parents? No, she has that. Wealth? Enough of it and more. They come from very good families, very well to do. Very well off families. So why then today all he has is an alms bowl and a robe? Bare feet. Why did they live in the lap of luxury and then give it all up to come and live a life of a beggar, a mendicant, a monk, with nothing to his name? Why? Have you seen his daytime wife? She's ugly, isn't she? Exactly. That's the point I'm trying to make. It's not easy to get into the profession that she used to work in. You've got to have brains and beauty, both. Then why, despite all that, did she choose to become an anagarika? You've got to really think about these things, ladies and gentlemen. These are the questions that will make a difference in your lives. Ask these questions and try and find answers to these questions. And then once you have found the answer, look within you. What is the gap that still remains in your heart that has to be filled? What's that gap? Where does this circuit short? There's some short circuit there. That's why it doesn't light up. What's missing? What's lacking? She became an anagarika because she wanted to learn how to love herself. Because she was someone who was at the mercy of others' love. Ladies are typically like that. You're always looking for love, affection, caring from others. That's because you don't love yourself enough. Therefore you're looking from it from the outside world. What we teach Anagarika Mahatmyas to do is to become a fountain of love. Become love itself. Then you don't need to go looking for love. When you become love itself, you become a source of love to everyone. I don't say that it happens overnight, but it's the practice that will eventually make that happen for you. That is why she came to the sasana, when she had a loving mother, loving father, loving husband. Right? Despite all that, single, the only child in the family. Can you imagine how much they must have been spoiled by their parents? If you are a single child, you know how you were spoiled. The same way. So these are those questions you have to really answer. Look for answers, ladies and gentlemen, and then try and find why that answer doesn't carry within you. I will help you figure the Dhamma out. Yes. Right? So that's the theory. Here's the practical side. And then try and marry these two things. Here's the theory. Here's the practical. I can see it happening. I can see people doing this. I can see young men, women going into the sasana, making this their livelihoods. Right? They're making this their entire life. So what's the gap? Why can it not work for me? That you have to do. That analysis, that self-reflection, you have to do. And please remember, this is not some kind of propaganda. It's not, let's try and get as many people to come and join the sasana or the monastery. No, it's not like that. You know it's not like that. What have we got to gain by building we are not here for popularity. We hardly even go by our names. What popularity? So it's not for popularity. It's not for a gathering. It's not to amass numbers or anything like that. Every person that comes and becomes a resident at the monastery adds more weight to the whole institution. Means more weight to our devotees. More weight to our monks, anagarikas, and all of it. So it's not for that. But it's because, like I said, when I look at you in your eyes, I see possibility. I can see how it can be possible. For you, madam. For you. You, sir. Madam. Sir. I can see that it is possible for you. And equally, I also know that all these efforts that you make outside of the sasana are really pointless. How do I know that? Not because I read it in a book, but because I went through that myself. We all speak with conviction. Enough and more. Life, lived experience. Lived experience. This is lived experience talking. I share with you my autobiography. Not someone else has written it. You're hearing my story from myself. You're still hearing his story from himself. You will hear her story from herself one day. All of these are stories of how people who were in your shoes, living your lives, in your professions, in your positions, in your situations and your circumstances, then found the truth and started walking to that truth. And how finally they found their salvation. If it's possible for them, you fill in the blanks. So where's the gap? Some of you are afraid. Some of you are scared to make that jump. You're worried what might happen. Some of you. But that fear must also be tackled with the Dhamma. The fear of what? Aren't you afraid of dying? Aren't you afraid of dying? What can you do about it? You're going to die anyway. There's no point in being afraid of dying because you're going to die anyway. Are you afraid of growing old? What's the point? Whether you're afraid or not, it's going to happen anyway. You know, one day, whether in this life or the next life, you're going to have to choose this path if you want to come out of samsara. You either do it now or do it later. One of these days, you're going to have to do it anyway. Because there's only one path out of suffering. Ekayanoyam bhikkave maggo sattanam visuddhiya. O monks, there's only one way out of suffering. Not two. There's only one path. For fearlessness. Only one path to fearlessness. Only one path to be free of sorrow. Free of grief. Only one path to understanding. And that is the noble path. This is what the Buddha said. He didn't see two paths. If he had, he would have shared it with us. There are no two paths. There's only one path. So either choose that path now, or choose it in the Maitri Buddha's time, choose it in the next Buddha's time, or the Buddha after's time. Whenever you choose it, you're going to have to do it. So if you're going to have to do it someday, why delay it? When you have everything going for you, why delay it? Why push it back? Why postpone it? Why procrastinate? When you can do it now, you're going to have to do it anyway. See, and the other thing is, folks, right? Today you live fairly comfortable lives. Let's be frank, let's be honest. You have a good family. Right? You have good parents. You have a supportive family. You know, you're fairly okay. Yeah, more or less, you're all fairly okay. There are many people who come and listen to the Dhamma, but they can't, for whatever reason, they can't go forward. If you are physically disabled in many ways, then that itself becomes a disqualification to come to the sasana. It's a pity. You can still listen to the Dhamma and attain Nibbana, but to come to the sasana, it becomes a disqualification. All you have to do is lose one of the digits of your hand or your foot. That's it. And that's a disqualification to come to the sasana. You don't have that problem, do you? So right now, things are in your favor. Everything is going for you. The stars have aligned. If I told you that you would win the next lottery, and if I can show you which ticket to buy, would you or would you not buy it? If I look into your future and I tell you, I prophesize that you're going to win the lottery, and I actually tell you which ticket to buy as well, I can see the winning numbers, Say, this is the talk literary ticket that you got to buy. Would you buy it or not? That you have to pay for the price of the ticket. I can't pay that for you. How much is the ticket these days? Lottery ticket? How much? 40. 40? In my days it was 20. When I was younger it was 10. So 40 now. Alright, 40 it is. So, but you have to pay that 40. But that is going to be the winning ticket. So if you win the jackpot, no, not if, as you're going to win the jackpot, you're going to get, say, 40 million. Are you or are you not prepared to spend 40 rupees on that? Are you or are you not? Any idiots in the house? No, so you're all going to buy that ticket, aren't you? Yeah? 40 rupees is a very small price to pay for 40 million. Yeah? Well then, I tell you, because the Buddha has said before me that if you practice this noble path, you will win the jackpot. It is not an if. Maybe, perhaps, no. It's a definite. If you practice the noble path, you will win. It's a definite. 100%. So he has prophesied that you will win the jackpot. And he didn't stop there. He also showed you the winning ticket, which is the path that you have to take to get there. The Noble Eightfold Path. He's given you the Dhamma. Anicchidukkhanatta. So that's the ticket. So here's the ticket and here's the jackpot. But you have to pay a small price. You have to buy the ticket. So why are you hesitant? Too expensive. 40 rupees? For 40 million? Is that why you're hesitating? Yes, you have to leave your car behind. You have to leave your house behind, but you will get a car when you need to travel. When you have to travel somewhere, we will give you a car. Is that not enough? Ah, no, you need a car when you travel and when you don't travel as well. Isn't it? I mean, what are you people like? That's the only difference between me and you. I don't have a car that belongs to me, but whenever I have to travel somewhere, there's a car and a driver. What about you? You also only use the car when you have to get somewhere. You don't use it otherwise, right? And either you have to drive most of the time, for most of you, or you have to hire a driver. You have to pay a driver's salary and you have to get a driver. Me, I don't have to. I don't need to service the car. I don't need to wash the car. I don't need to drive the car. I just sit in the car like those very successful businessmen, right, who are driven in the back seat. Have you seen successful businessmen drive their cars? The very successful businessmen, they don't drive their cars. They get a driver to do that. And they rest or do their work. They do their business on the move. I do my business on the move. My business is contemplating the Dhamma. That's what I do. That's how I make my money. Why don't you want to live the good life? Because you want to have the car in the garage when you use it and when you don't as well. My question to you is, what good does that car do to you when you don't drive it? How does it serve you? And that's the difference between you and I. For the last several years, right, I can't remember a day I washed my robes. Excuse me. For the last many years, I can't remember me washing my robes because there's always someone who likes to have the opportunity to do it for me. Either Swami Nuhanse or Nanagarika Mata comes and collects my robes and says, "Venerable sir, please may we have the opportunity to wash them." How much do I pay them? How much do I have to pay them? But if you wanted someone to come and collect your clothes and wash them for you, would you not have to pay them? And you call them a maid or servants, housemaids. And you'd have to pay them, right? Then, who's living the better life? I ask you, who's living the better life? You tell me what's in it for you. Why do you want to do what you're doing? Where's the benefit? I mean, I take you to be very intelligent people. Otherwise, you have to tell me, "No, Swami, don't assume us to be intelligent people like that. How dare you? Right? Don't make such assumptions of us. We are as stupid as they come." But, you know, I struggle to come to that conclusion. I think you are very bright, very intelligent, very smart people. So then I have to ask and pose this question to you. What is it? I only cook when I like to. When I want to earn some merits, I go to the kitchen and help out. All other times my meals are ready, either in the monastery or I take my alms bowl and go out. And it's always a very, very cordial exchange between those who serve me my meals. And they don't smile because they have to. Unlike, you know, if you hire a butler, do you think they smile at you because they love you? They'll smile because you give them a tip. Or the waiter at the restaurant, they'll smile at you because you give a hopeful that you might leave a tip for them. But when I go on alms round, why do they smile? They don't just smile, they get on their knees and they worship. And Swami says, "Please accept this alms offering. Please would you accept this alms offering?" And how much have I got to pay for that? No, I've had all my, you know, there is such a thing called a free lunch. You always say there is no such thing called a free lunch. Well, there is. Now, granted, we have to pay by merits. Yes, but I'm always earning them. I earn merits at a faster rate than I spend them. Whereas on your part, it's not always true. You spend your merits much faster than you earn them. Otherwise, how is it possible that the Buddha would say one day, "Ananda, most humans, when they die, they simply go to hell"? If it's possible that you earn more merits than you spend, right, then that could not be true. Then that cannot be true, right? In a lay life, I'm sorry to spell this out in these words to you, ladies and gentlemen, in a lay life, you spend your merits much faster, much, much faster than you earn them. Therefore, you're at the mercy of your previous or prior merits. Hardly do you earn new merits. At least now you have come close to a sasana. You're beginning to be mindful about how you conduct yourself and earn merits as you go along. But typically speaking, it's not so. Because, you know, when you cook for yourself, when you cook for your family, how can you earn merits out of that? Because you're doing it out of lobha. If you might cook meals for others, that's generosity, that's charity. You earn some merits by doing that. But by cooking for your children, by sending your children to the best schools, you think you earn merits out of that? Hardly any at all. You might earn a little bit of merits because they are human beings. But the moment you think of them as your children, right, and you and them, your selfishness comes out. Selfishness taints the power of merit. The value of merit is tainted by selfishness. That's why I asked you the other day, if you really wanted to become parents, why didn't you just adopt a child from an orphanage? No, you wanted to have your own children. What does that say? Selfishness. So the moment selfishness comes into the picture, that taints the value of merits. I don't look after my children. I look after our children. We look after our children. Everyone in this world, all of them are our children. That's why these merits that we do are not tainted by selfishness. Therefore, we earn lots of merits by doing it. Our monks, our anagarikas, they teach at the school and they earn lots and lots and lots of merits by doing it. That's why when you come closer and closer to the sasana, you have more potential to earn more merits because you're not doing it for yourself, to foster, to nurture, nourish the self. The moment self comes into the picture, ladies and gentlemen, it just spoils the whole thing. What's that idiom? There's one in Sinhalese. You take a pot of milk and you drop the dung. Yeah? So, quite similar. It's like getting a pot of milk, drawing a pot of milk, and then putting a bit of dung into it. Spoils the whole thing. Ruins the whole thing. Selfishness ruins the whole thing. But unfortunately, in the lay lifestyle, there's ample and always, you are always encouraged to think selfishly. Look after your people, look after yourself, put up your walls high, lock your doors, lock your gates, put the alarms, put the security systems, have the dog, train it to look after the master and its family. See? Open a bank account, put money for you and your family. Isn't that what they encourage you to do? Save for you and your family and your future. See, it's always about you, you and who? You. Yes. When you buy a piece of land, who do you buy it for? You and your family. When you put some money into your savings account, who do you do it for? You and your family. When you go shopping, who do you do it for? You and your family. When you go shopping on an Urdu, New Year's, Christmas, who do you do it for? You and your family. You and your family and you and your friends. There's always who in there? You. Which is? What ishness? Selfishness. So the moment selfishness creeps in, that devalues the power of merit. That's why it's very difficult to earn merits by doing what you're doing with a lay attitude. I'm talking about the lay attitude. When you feed your dog, your pet dog, yes, you earn a little bit of merits, even less than feeding a human being, but you earn a little bit of merits because it's an animal anyway. Right? But because it's your dog, again, selfishness creeps in. It's, you know, more meritorious to feed a stray dog. Did you know it was more meritorious to feed a stray dog than to feed your own dog? But what do most people like to do? Sometimes they catch a stray dog, right? And they domesticate the stray dog. Now they call it my dog, and then they feed that dog. Oh, God. I tell you, it was 10 times more meritorious to feed it while it was still the stray dog. But that's not how we are engineered to think. We're always engineered to make it me and make it mine. Bring everything closer and closer and closer to me. Hoard. That's how we are programmed. This is what our drishtis have done for us. Whose birthdays do you celebrate? Yours? Your husband's? Wives? Mothers? Fathers? Brothers? Sisters? Maybe, but when they are older and they leave, that's it. And then children. Do you celebrate Mahatma Gandhi's birthday? He said, but we celebrate Jesus Christ's birthday. We celebrate the Buddha's birthday. Yes, that's good. You get more merits by celebrating Mahatma Gandhi's birthday than by celebrating your birthdays. Because you don't get anything from celebrating your birthdays, ladies and gentlemen. Honestly, not a dime. You get nothing for celebrating your birthdays. Every cake you bake, every candle you blow out, it simply drains even more merit. So you start the new year in the red. That's what you do to yourselves. That's why what I truly admire what some people do on their birthdays, they don't celebrate at home, right? They take the celebration elsewhere. They go to an orphanage, they go to an old people's home, right? I mean, even do a balukaputudana, still okay. Feed the crows and the dogs. Stray ones, but don't domesticate the crows. I mean, at the rate that people are going. Let the crows be crows, right? Don't, because the moment you domesticate that animal, what happens? Nothing has changed with the animal. The animal doesn't know that it's been domesticated and now it belongs to you because nothing belongs to you anyway. But your thoughts are now defiled with what ishness? Selfishness. You like feeding the fish? Then go to the local lake or local pond or somewhere and put some, what do you call it? Fish food or, you know, bread or whatever, right? That is 10 times, 50 times, 100 times more meritorious than to do what? Have a fish tank at home and feed those animals. Why? Because when they're your fish, what is the intention now? Selfishness. Yes, feeding, but it's tainted by selfishness. You'll have to feed 100 fish in your fish tank to get the merit that you earn by feeding one fish in the local pond or in the local tank somewhere down the street. So you never thought about life this way, did you? That's what I'm saying. Let's open our eyes, wake up. Because here's what I know, that here's what I do know about you, with or without my teaching, with or without the Buddha's teaching, that is, you're consuming your merits. Every waking moment is merit consumed. Every meal you take is merit consumed. Every peaceful night you take is merit consumed. Every drink of water you take is merit consumed. If it's not merit, tell me what it is you're consuming. Otherwise, how come some people have and others don't? What's the logic behind it? Luck by chance? Random? There's no randomness. Remember, God is always fair. God is always fair. I don't like those people who go up to God and say, "Hey God, how come they get and I don't? Aren't you supposed to love us all the same?" Well, yes, He does love us all the same, and therefore He made the rules the same for everyone. That's how He showed us love. In the same way, for everyone. He's equal. He treats everyone equal. The rules are the same for everyone. It's a level platform, level playing field. You can't expect more than that from God, can you? If the rules are the same, what more are you asking for? Therefore then, you tell me, how come there are some people, some in some part of this world, who are starving, haven't got a meal to eat, haven't got a drink, a drop of water to drink, they're homeless, they have no parents. They go picking their breakfast out in these dumps. That's where they find a meal. And then there are people in another part of the world who've just got an abundance of choice. Every morning they wake up to a feast. It's not breakfast. Feast. How is that possible? How do you explain that? Chance? Random? Random? What random? Nothing in this world is random. All in there is in this world is hetum paticca sambhutam hetu bhanga nirujjati. That's it. It's all cause and effect. So what are those causes then that bring out these effects? Merit or the lack of it. Simple as that. You live in a nice house. There are those who live under the bridges. Every day when we go leave the sermon, Rajagiriya, and take that turn back to Ingria, you know, we drive under that Rajagiriya bridge. Yeah, the one leading up to Borella. Yeah, and there's always someone, a few people who are sleeping under the bridge, homeless people. But then just opposite that, are high-rise mansions, very luxury apartments. One might say, see how unfair. Why don't these people who have so much give to those people who don't have enough? Right? And why can't everyone just be fair? And why can't we just share equally among everyone? No. It's not material that we share equally. It's the rules of the game. The rules of the game is the same for everyone. Do you agree with me? The rules of the game are the same for everyone. You earn merits, you reap them. You reap what you sow. That's the same for everyone. But not how much money you have in your bank account. So I'm not a proponent of the idea that let's collect everyone's cash, split it up into equal portions, and let everyone have their fair share. Or an equal share. Let's assume that we did that. I'll tell you in 6 months' time what's going to happen. In 6 months' time, all the money will be back where it belongs. With the people who have merits to have it. That's how it is. That's why you can't make a poor man rich. You give a poor man a lot of money, he'll be rich for 2 months, maybe 2 weeks, maybe even 2 days. Very soon, the fool and his money are parted. You can't make people rich like that. You can't feed the hunger like that. Because you have to understand the rules of the game. To feed the hungry, you have to teach them how to get food. And to get food, you must, what food? Give food. But when we feed the hunger, what do? You know, the United Nations, these food programs, you know, all sorts, government authorities, agencies, what do? They collect from people who are willing to give. Yeah, that's what they do, right? They collect from people who are willing to give and fill them up in big vehicles, lorries, whatever, and then go and distribute it to those who don't have. I'm not speaking against that. But what I'm saying is, that's just a plaster. That does not fix the problem. Because you've only fed the hunger. You haven't taught them how to find their own food. For that, you have to teach them the principle or the law of cause and effect. The law of what you give is what you get. Because otherwise, every day, you know, the thing is, see, that practice of taking from those who are willing to give and going and giving to those who don't only feed the same cycle. So those who are willing to give will always get more because they always give. That's why the rich become richer and the poor keep becoming poorer. That's how this world is so polarized. There are those who are very rich and there are those who are very poor. You can't change the system without educating people, enlightening people. Like I said, take all the money in the world from the billionaires, from the millionaires, take all that money. Someone said the other day, I think it was Elon Musk. Someone said, I think he has assets worth of $62 billion or something. He has amassed that much of wealth. And someone is saying, well, there are only 8 billion people in the world. So why can't we give each one 1 billion? And then he'll still have enough spare. Assume we did that. Just imagine we did that. Give everyone 1 billion of his wealth. And give it 5 years, what's going to happen again? Right now he has 62, right? If he was willing to share his wealth with all 8 billion people, in 5 years' time, he will become... Right now he has 62 billion, he'll have 620 billion. Why? Because he's given, exactly. Because he's given. And the others, what have they done? They've taken. That's what they've done. They've taken. How much merit do you earn by taking things? How much? You don't. You consume your merits by taking things. You don't earn merits by taking things. You earn by giving. So until people understand this principle, ladies and gentlemen, you know, there's no, you can't fix the world's problem like that. You have to teach this. People have to understand this. People have to learn this, and it has to become their way of life. Therefore, to this day, whatever it is you have got, it's because you have given. If you have a nice home today, it's because you have helped people find a good home. People or someone, you've helped someone find a good home. If you had the fortune of having good teachers, it's because you have always guided people towards the teacher. If you have good parents, it's because you have always been a good parent to someone, or given parenthood, been a mother to someone, been a father to someone, either biologically or in other ways. If you have good friends, friends you can trust, it's because you have given trust. You have not broken trust. That's why. You are educated today because you've given education. You're wealthy today because you have given wealth. Or at least the feeling of wealthiness. These are the rules. And it's the same for everyone. Don't ask for more fairness than that. You won't get it anyway. You will only be disappointed, that's all. If you ask for more fairness than that, you will only be disappointed. Because this is the best that it can be. The system has been designed to favor those who understand the system. That's how it works. Once again, the system's been designed to favor those who understand the system. So if you want favor, if you want the world to work in your favor, all you've got to do is what? Understand the system. Because once you understand the system, then that knowledge cannot be taken from you. Knowledge cannot be stolen, right? Your wealth can be stolen, but your knowledge cannot be stolen. Therefore, once you understand the system, that knowledge cannot be taken from you, that cannot be stolen from you. Therefore, no one can stop you from living what you have understood. Therefore, don't be worried about what you have today. Be worried, though, about what you don't give today. Don't be worried about what you don't have today. Don't. Take my word. See, I don't have much at all. What is my net worth? I'm not worth. I'm not worth anything, really. I have no material wealth or no material value today. Those days I used to be a banker. People liked to know me. Because they thought I can help make things happen for them. I understood money, I knew how to make money work for them. I was a technologist, so people wanted to associate with me for my knowledge, to get what they could from me. Then I amassed wealth, I amassed property, and people wanted to get to know me, be with me, so that they could shine in the same light, get some of that for them. Today I don't have any of that. My knowledge of technology is not up to date. My knowledge of banking is way behind now. I can't remember the last time I held, counted any money at all. Even counted money. I can't remember the last time I did that. So the only thing I know today is the Buddha's philosophy and how to guide people in that direction so that they can achieve the same bliss and liberation that the Buddha once did. That's all I have today. I don't have anything else really. See, these are my assets. It's rope and that arm's pole. I don't even have shoes to wear today. I don't even have socks. I depend on you for my sustenance. If you choose not to give, then I don't have. I only have what you choose to give. But I'm not worried about what I don't have. But if ever there's a day in my life where I have not given, I'm worried about that. So at the end of every day before I go to sleep, I check, what have I given today? What have I given today? What have I given today? Did I give the Dhamma? Did I give energy? Did I give love? Did I give affection? Did I give strength? Did I give courage? Did I give fearlessness? Did I lend a ear to someone who had a problem, who wanted to share their problem with me? Have I given enough today? So once I've done all that, I give the Buddha a glass of water before I go to bed. Just to top it all up with that final giving. And then do my merit transfer, another giving. That's how my life and my days are spent. I don't worry about what I don't have. Seriously, you have no idea what a carefree life I live today. Just not having to worry about what I don't have. Such an easy life. And when you stop worrying about what you don't have, and focus that energy, right? Focus that energy on giving. And start thinking about what is it that other people don't have that I have so that I can give them. That shifts your focus. It shifts your attention. 180 degrees in the other direction. Then the universe responds to that. It's like the universe has a mind of its own. The universe always wants to provide. It doesn't want to keep for itself. The universe is naturally a provider. That's what the universe is. It's not a hoarder. The universe provides. That's why you call it Mother Universe. She's a mother. Right? So she provides. So what she does is, she looks at ways in which she can provide. It's like, where there's pressure, when you want to release pressure, you find the point of least pressure, right? That's how pressure can be released. So there's a lot of opportunity, a lot of potential for giving in the universe, and then what the universe does is, it looks at those places where there is least pressure. Where there are places that don't hoard, don't hold, don't keep for themselves, but simply give. Because those are those points of very little or no pressure at all. And then what she does is, she sends it their way. But if you have a lot of pressure, if I had a lot of pressure, always holding things up, gathering things for myself, stocking things up for myself, then pressure builds up on my side. Right? Then the difference in potential between the universe and me is very little. Therefore, the universe chooses not to send things through me. That's why I have everything I need. I have so much that I'm inviting all of you to come in. Take what I'm happy to give and share with you. I have everything I need. I have you. I have all of you. You only have yourself. I have your children. I have your husbands. I have your wives. I have your friends. I have your brothers and your sisters. I have the best and the smartest brains in this country. They're all with me. I have the brightest minds in the world. They're with me. I have the most loving people. The gentlest, the kindest, the most sincere, the selfless. Where are they all? They're all with me. Who's with you? People who want things from you. See, I have it all. All I had to do was stop thinking about myself. If you can stop thinking about yourself, then the universe, being what she is, she provides. She will always look for the path of least resistance. That is what she does. Like a current that flows. You know, when there's lightning strike, what do those lightning strikes always do? That energy is looking for the path of least resistance because it wants to ground itself. That's how lightning arresters work. They have very little resistance in comparison to the environment. Therefore, the moment it strikes, it's grounded. So, if I can become someone with very little resistance, a synonym for resistance is selfishness. So, if I can become someone with very little resistance, then the universe provides in abundance. The universe comes to me and says, please, would you have some more? That's what the universe says. You know, every day after our sermon, right? With great difficulty, I have to stop you from putting stuff into that alms bowl, right? Your food. There's always enough and more. I eat about this much. That's all I can eat. But how much do you give me? Let me put it in different words. How much does the universe give me? An alms bowl full. I can barely carry that thing once you've filled it up with food. Therefore, I take the little that I can eat and the rest of it ends with the children at the monastery. With my babies. I take the very little I can eat. But why does the universe give me so much? There's no resistance. I don't stock it up for me, for myself. We are building that in Dambulla, the granary together, right? The granary and the rice mill facility there. Who are we doing it for? Me? The residents of the monastery? No, for everyone. Everyone and anyone who comes in and says, I'm hungry, please feed me. That's what we are working on. Let me tell you something, ladies and gentlemen. Even your sadhukar, to a project like that, even your sadhukara, let alone your financial contributions, right? Even your sadhukara to something like that will earn you so much more merits than whatever merits you might have earned having fed your family for the last 15 years, 20 years, 30 years. Oh, I promise you that. Yes, at home you've been feeding 2, 3, 4, 5 people, but always tainted with what? What ishness? Selfishness. It's like you have a big pail which you can fill with water. You drop it into the well, you lower it into the well, you pull it up, right? And imagine this pail has holes in it. Just imagine a pail but with holes in it. It's a big pail, big one. It's big, right? So you can get a lot. But it's got holes in the bottom. So what happens by the time it comes to you? Barely anything at all. Sometimes the pail is, if you leave it too long, it's empty. There's hardly anything in it. That's what selfishness does. That is exactly what happens when you're selfish with your merits. That's why Guru Chandra always keeps going on about, you know, feeding your children, teaching your children, looking after your children. It hardly earns you any merits, ladies and gentlemen. And the reason he says that is this. It is because it's always tainted with selfishness. Selfishness is lobha dosa moha. Selflessness is alobha adosa amoha. So every time you do something with selfishness, it doesn't matter how much effort you've put into to take that water out of the well, all the water just has been drained. Is leaked out of the pail. So it's hardly anything left. But the effort you put in is the same. The effort's the same. But the return on investment? Barely anything at all. What does a good businessman always do before he invests his assets? Work out the return on investment. You're not a good businessman if you can't work that out. So in life, you have all been given merits. This is your cash. Right? This is your assets. You can spend this to get something back. Spend your merits and earn something out of it. This is all you have to make investments with. We think we have cash, but it's not cash we invest. We invest our merits. But that return on investment is always diluted because of selfishness. Once again, I tell you, feed the stray dogs. Don't feed the stray dogs. I'm just saying. Because then the authorities will come and catch you and you'll say, Swami Nuhan says, go feed the stray dogs. You'll point your finger at me. I'm not this, I don't mean this literally, but I'm trying to get the point across to you, right? Feeding a stray dog earns you more merits than feeding your dog at home. And I've proven it to you why it is so. If you can find a stray dog and take it to a, what do you call these places? Shelter for animals, kennels, right? These shelters for animals. If you can find a stray dog and go and leave one there, right? And then say, right, I will sponsor for this animal's well-being for the next 3 months. After that, I can't afford it, but for the next 3 months, at least it can have a good life. If you can do that, that is far more meritorious than buying a dog from a pet shop, bringing it home, and looking after it for 3 years. 3 months, 3 years. Why? One is selfish. My dog. The moment my comes into it, trust me folks, the moment my creeps into it, right, that's a loss. It's like milking your cow and getting a pot full of milk and then holding your hand behind the cow's backside when it does the dirty, right? And then taking a handful of that and coming and dropping it into the pot. Now what can you do with that milk? What can you do with that milk? Nothing more than throw it out, right? In vain, all that milk, isn't it? Exactly what happens when you become selfish. It's still milk, yes. Yeah, 1%, maybe you can use it if you save it quickly enough. If you are quick enough, you might be able to save 1% of it. But the most of it, you're going to have to throw anyway. That's why I'm trying to encourage you to come out of this self-based thinking. That's why I'm teaching the Dhamma to you, so that even your merits can be more potent. Otherwise, what's happening right now is, you have been born with a lot of merits. That's why you have been born to good families. That's why you're affluent. That's why you've born to wealthy families, to good parents, have found good teachers, have got good education, right? You are good and well in many ways. But what you're doing is really consuming merits that you have been born with. And once that's consumed, you will end up with an empty tank. After that, you're no better than a man who has no merits at all. That's why the rules are fair and equal for everyone. It's like the law. The law doesn't favor. Yeah? The law doesn't favor. The law of the universe doesn't favor either. So when there are people marching for equal rights, What I have to say is the rights are already equal. Don't you agree? Equal rights for women. Yeah, the rights are already equal. What more equality are you asking for? Equal pay. Yes, the rights are already equal. The pay structure is already equal. You're not getting paid less because you're a woman. That's not the reason. What you give is what you get. It's already equal. It's fair. It's always fair. It's always been fair. See, when you understand this, you stop making enemies with the system. You stop making enemies with the authorities. You stop making enemies with your bosses, right? With the HR, with the director board, with the country, with the laws, with the systems, with the regulations. You stop making enemies with any of these things and you realize who is your own enemy. Who is your only enemy? Yourself. You are your only enemy. What I've done in the past, the bad I've done in the past is my enemy. The good I've done in the past is my friend. See how empowering the Dhamma is? See how empowering the Dhamma is, ladies and gentlemen? This is the gift of Dhamma. It empowers you. You become your own master. There are slaves slaving today because they have always slaved others. Now it's coming back to bite them. So don't slave anyone. But that's not to say don't hire someone. I'm not saying you shouldn't get a housemaid. Do it and give them an opportunity. But have that intention. It's not to enslave them. It's to liberate them. If there's someone who's looking for work, right? And you have some work to offer them, then do so. You can call them a housemaid, it's okay. But not to enslave them. Treat them with dignity. For that is what you will be treated in return. Treat them with respect. I'm not saying get on your knees and worship them when they walk in. That's not what I'm suggesting. But you don't have to be harsh to them. Shouldn't be mean to them. Shouldn't be evil to them. Remember, whatever you do is recorded. Every word you say, not the word, but the intention with which you say, that's recorded. That becomes your karma. Because when you treat someone with dignity, or when you treat them with, what was the opposite of that? When you degrade someone, yeah. Okay, when you treat someone with dignity or when you degrade someone with the words you use, it doesn't matter what their position is in society. It doesn't matter. Whether they're a senior official or they're a beggar on the street, none of that matters. Because the only thing that is checked is intention, intention, intention. What is the intention? It's like the universe always watches you. It doesn't look at who it is you're dealing with. You must always looks at you. What intention do you have? What is the intention with which you release it into your karmic strand? That's why I've said in the past, it's even wrong to hit the person who's hit you first. It's wrong to steal from the person who has stolen from you. It's wrong to insult the person who has insulted you. It's wrong. If you love yourself, you would never do that. Because if what you give is what you get, then must you not always be mindful about what you give to others? So, like I said, I've never washed my arms, but I washed my robes, not in the last many years. But here's what I do always. When someone comes and asks for my robes, I will make sure that I fold it carefully, with a lot of respect and love. And then with both my hands, I present it to them because it's a present. This is the robe to be washed. This is the robe to be washed, not the wash robe. So much so that the wash robe and the robe to be washed, if you keep them either, you know, beside each other, you would not be able to tell which one's which. I take great care to make sure that this is a gift that I make to the individual who has come to take that opportunity. Because I know what I give is what I get. I'm not going to give someone something that is dirty. I'm not a fool. This is not dirty linen I hand over to someone. It's an opportunity to earn merits. So if I offer that, what do I get back? An opportunity to earn merits. It's not the thing, it's the intention. Always that, ladies and gentlemen, it's always that. Not the thing, it's the intention. That's why I say quantity doesn't matter. Intention matters. Does this not make you think, rethink about life and the choices that you make in your lives? That's what I want for you. I want you to take this teaching, take it home and re-examine every choice you make in your life. Go back to your past and think about some of the choices you've made in the past and ask yourself, did I make the right choice? If I've made some not so good choices, then the next time that choice comes to me, I will make the right one. Because you're answerable to all those choices. When is Judgment Day? There's the biblical context. Judgment Day, that's a different one. Your understanding of karma and vipaka, when is Judgment Day? Now. Now. Whatever you do, the intention with behind it, behind with, or the intention behind what you do is always judged. Either white karma, bad, black karma, white karma, black karma, white karma, white karma, white karma, black karma, black karma, black karma. That's how it works. It's always judged. How is it judged? How is it judged? It's judged depending on how you judge. You are the judge. In a funny enough way, you are your own judge. It's very funny how that works. You are your own judge. So you look at a man and you judge him a criminal. You look at a man and you judge him a bad person. That is a judgment you give unto yourself. You look at a man and you judge him a good person. That is a judgment you give unto yourself. That's why it is said, judge and you shall be judged. Because there is no one to judge, only judgment. There's no one to judge, only judgment. Does that make sense to you? There's no one to judge because there's no one there to be judged, ladies and gentlemen, because all these ones are all our own imaginations. So there's no one to judge, but the judgment alone remains. That judgment goes into your book. So rethink those choices. Make smarter choices from here on. From here on, make smarter choices. Make the right choices. Don't make the popular choices. Don't make the easy choices just because they are popular or easy. Easy and popular never got you very far. Make the right choice. Even if it's hard, even if it's a hard choice to make, make the right choice. Make righteous choices. And for that you need the Dhamma. The universe always favors those who understand the universe. It always favors. That's why Sammadipti is the liberating force. Michchadipti is the force that confines you. It incarcerates you. It imprisons you. Michchaditti is even one of the 10 unmeritorious deeds. It's a mental deed. Not physical, not verbal. It's a mental deed, Michchaditti. To free yourself from that, the work you do to free yourself from that is a merit. So, whenever you do these merits, because you do a lot of merits, I know you do, try and take that selfishness part out of it. And it, you can't just do it like that. You need the Dhamma for that, but that's why we learn the Dhamma. I'm not asking you to suppress self. That's not what I'm asking you to do. I'm asking you to, or I'm inviting you to, understand what the self is. Because once you understand that, there's nothing to suppress. You just got to understand it. It's like fear. You know, when there's a child who's afraid of exams, what do you do? Your child's afraid of an upcoming exam. What do you do? Do you talk to the child and say, okay, you don't have to do the exam? What do? You talk to the child and explain to them, right? Buddha, there's nothing to worry. You just go and do the exam. Whatever result comes, comes. Right? Don't worry about the result. Just do the exam. So what are you actually trying to help them? Understand that this fear is baseless. There's no point in being afraid of it. So you help them understand what fear is. It's only a mental response. And fear is not productive. It's not useful. It doesn't help in any way. Or if they're afraid to go out in the dark when the lights are out, right? And the little one doesn't want to go down to the ground floor. You're in the top floor. Right? They're scared. What do you do? When they're very young, you might turn on the lights and say, okay, yeah, I've turned on the lights, now go. Then they're not scared. But are you always going to leave them like that? If your child is afraid of the dark, are you just going to always keep putting the lights on? What do? You teach them, right? There's nothing to be afraid of the dark. It's just darkness. No one's there. There's nothing spooky. There are no ghosts or anything there. Don't worry. Just because you can't see doesn't mean there's anything harmful there. So to do that, you take them by their hand, you hold them, and you walk them down the stairs in the dark and say, see, Putarak, did anything happen? Did anything bad happen? Did the dark do anything to you? No, right? Okay. Then they understand. So you help them come out of fear by helping them realize that fear is only a mental response. It's not about suppressing fear. It's about understanding fear. And what is it that causes fear? In the same way, I'm not asking you to suppress the self, because it's pointless to ask you to do that. You can't do it. It's impossible to suppress the self. That's the one thing you can't suppress. Self. You can suppress your fears, you can suppress greed, you can suppress anger, you can suppress joy and laughter and all those things, but self is not something you can suppress. How can you suppress something that you don't even know is happening? you understand fear because it doesn't happen all the time. It doesn't happen all of the time. Because it doesn't happen all of the time, you are sensitive to when it does happen. Now that's fear. You understand happiness because it doesn't happen all of the time. You understand sleepiness because it doesn't happen all of the time only on Sunday mornings. You understand hunger because it doesn't happen all of the time. What if you are always hungry? Would you be able to distinguish hunger as a feeling? No. If you are always afraid, would you be able to distinguish fear as a feeling, as an emotion? You wouldn't be able to. Then tell me, how can you identify self? You can't. So how can you suppress something you can't even identify? Because you were born with it. It's congenital. You were born with self. The sense of self. You will live with the sense of self. You will die with the sense of self, and you'll be born again with the sense of self. There's never a moment when you have not experienced freedom. Or there's never a moment when you have experienced a freedom from the sense of self. It's always been there. Because it's always been there, you've never known a life without it. So how can you suppress that? When you can't even catch it in action. The day that you identify what self is the day that you understand the Dhamma. Through wisdom you understand, that's what it is. That happens when wisdom arises. It's a very special moment. When you realize that it's not me, it's only the feeling of me, that's a huge shift. This is not me. It's just a feeling I have. It's like when someone tickles you. Why can't you tickle yourself? Can you? Ever tried? You can't tickle yourself. But if you have these tickly places in your body, around the ears, I don't know, places wherever you have tickly places, they don't even have to touch you, right? Just the thought that they might touch you there is ticklish, is it not? Yeah. But you can't do it to save your life. You can't do it yourself, right? So then do you not understand that this feeling is not something that originates from some part of the body? Do you not get that? It's not something that originates in some physical part of your body. It has to be something that is born in the mind itself. Because if it originates in some part of your body, why can't you do it yourself? It should be self-triggered, but it's not. But pain is not so. See, that hurts. Whether you do it or I do it to myself. Yeah? And that hurts. That feels good. Whether you do it or I do it to myself. But ticklishness, that's not a physical response. That's a mental response. Just like that. Your sense of self is also a mental concoction. You are the chef. And your mind is the kitchen. Ignorance and attachment are the ingredients. And you cook up this sense of self. But there comes a point one day, while you are contemplating the Dhamma, you come to that realization, hey, this is not me. This is only the sense of me. The feeling of me. Therefore, it's only a feeling. It's not a real thing. Then even if you use the word I, you will use it, but with some hesitance. You know that it is not I you are referring to. It's not the same I that you've been talking about all these times, all these years, or all your life. You realize that this, although I call it I, it's not really I. This is just pachupan. This is just this moment. That's it. What I? But for convention, I will use that word. See, that's something you can't suppress forcefully. Because it happens. And until you come to your realization, you will never be able to distinguish. So what are these sermons, what are they intended to do? To help you come to that realization. Because I'm talking about something you cannot suppress, ladies and gentlemen. Unlike anger, you can't just take a walk and the sense of self is gone with it. You know, when you're angry, what do they do? What do they ask you to do? Go take a walk. When you're annoyed, you know, just go take a walk. When you're stressed, go for a walk in the park. When you come back, it's all gone. If it's too much, then take a nap. Yeah? Once you wake up, it's all gone. Can you do the same with your sense of self? Why do you scream in your nightmares? Sense of self. Why do you have some dreams from which you don't even like to wake up? Because those dreams are lovelier than your real life itself. Again, sense of self. So you can, you know, see the husband you never had, although you never could have had. That's your sense of self again. That's your sense of self. So is there ever a moment where you are without your sense of self? No, therefore you can't suppress it. It's always there. You've never known a time or a day without it. Not a moment without it. In your sleep, it's there. When you're awake, it's there. When you're having a meal, it's there. When you're going for a walk, it's there. When you're crying, it's there. When you're laughing, it's there. When you're jumping up and down, it's there. When you're sat down, it's there. It's always there. From death to birth to death to birth, it's there. Not self, but the sense of self. But because you don't understand, not you, but generally I'm speaking, generally because people don't understand that this self is only a sense of self, they never see it that way. Because the sense of self can only be seen through wisdom. And when Alavakadaya asked the Buddha, how does one achieve wisdom? And the Buddha says, Susutai Labhati Panya. Through listening, you arrive at wisdom. That is how wisdom arises. You have to listen for wisdom to arise. You can't gain wisdom by through your eyes. You can't look at something and wisdom arises. It has to be heard. The Dhamma has to be heard. It can't be read. Once you have gained that wisdom, then after that you can, you know, it's like a machine has started to, the cogs have started to turn in your mind. After that, any amount of Dhamma can come through your eyes. And you will start to see everything in that context, from that perspective. But the very first realization has to happen out of hearing something. That is why from back then to this day, the Mahasangha has been preaching the Dhamma. Yes, we write things, we produce literature, it's available to read and whatnot. But that, if you stuck to that as an exclusive medium and not do sermons, then that would be the end of the sasana. No Aryans would be born again. So for as long as they can, those who have understood the Dhamma must preach it. You must preach it. Don't have to have a stadium or a podium or a stage for that. Share it with those who are willing to listen to it. Hear it from you. But do you understand why your sense of self, your selfishness, taints the amount of or whatever merits you do? Because it makes it all selfish. And the sad part of it is, ladies and gentlemen, with or without the self, the effort that you have to make is the same. Like I said, to bring that water out of the well, to pull that water out of the well, the same effort, yeah? But with those holes in the pail, whatever water you pull up is just going to leak out of it. Then in the end, you have put all that effort to pull it up, but you take the bucket and in it is hardly any water at all. So often, what use is it to you? Do you understand now why merit and kusal has to be done together? Merit is all that meritorious deeds we do. You know, we build the granary, we build the monastery, we do schools, we teach, right? We learn, we lay the sermon hall out, we put the lights on, put the fans on, right? We feed, right? We educate, we clothe. You offer robes and medicines and all that. These are all merits. Yeah? But do you understand why that alone is not going to be enough? These are like, you know, kusal is like those levers. I don't know if you remember your lessons from physics. There are these, I think they are third class levers. Those levers, like the broomstick. So this is actually quite a nice concept to think of it in that way. When you use the broom, where you base your fulcrum, either here, 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 here. So that's where you hold it basically. It is the point it rotates. Yeah? When you put it up here, you say you held the broom right up at the end of the stick or the handle and stick. To make any considerable movement in this space, you have to put how much effort up here? Quite a lot of effort. To make it move, you're going to have to put a lot of effort. But if you move the fulcrum down along the stick, yeah, you can reduce the amount of force that you have to apply. Because the formula is force times distance is work done. So the work done up here is the work done down here. So when you move this fulcrum down here, then your work done equals the force times distance. So the distance increases, therefore less force can get the same work done. But if you move the fulcrum further up, then to get the same amount of work done, because the distance is now very low, very less, you have to put in quite a lot of force. So sweeping with this broom is like doing merit. That's what sweeping with the broom is like. What is kusa? Which is the effort that you put into free yourself from the sense of self. So this is the point of rotation is this, because the broom always rotates along this point. So it's not the point of rotation. That is the fulcrum, right? So this is the fulcrum. Thank you. We have a doctor in physics. No, he is actually. And then the distance is the distance from the point of rotation to where you apply the effort. Yeah. So if you apply the effort there initially, then you have to apply a lot of force. But if you lower that point to, say, down here, which is usually how you hold the broom, you don't hold it right up there. You hold it sort of halfway down, right? Then you can put little effort and get either the same or more work done, basically the same work done. You can transfer that work done onto the other side. See, this is what kusal is. Lowering this point of application of effort. Same merit, but less effort. So, same pitcher of water, same pail of water, but less effort. If it had holes in it, to get a certain quantity of water, you're going to have to do it so many times because it's got holes. Hardly any water will remain by the point it comes to the top. But if it didn't have any holes, then one time would be enough. This is why it's really important, ladies and gentlemen, that you don't just do merits, but you also understand the Dhamma so that you can magnify and amplify the power of your merit. And let's not forget the critical point here. To understand the Dhamma as well, what do you need? You need merits. To understand the Dhamma alone itself, you need merits. Without merits, you can't understand the Dhamma. So if you assume that this is where you started, even if this is where you started, you have to still do it so that later on you can lower this point further down and make the movement easier for you and get more work done with the same amount of force. Even that requires starting. That's why I said the other day, the only journey that ended was the one that started. See, this is a journey that has come to some end. But he says, this is only the beginning. In another way, yes. In one way, he's ended one journey. As we were getting out of the lift to come in here, there were three monks and three of you, Mahatyas, holding the mudukuda. And I was saying, three of us have completed. Three of us have ended the journey. Another three are yet to begin. Do you see this interconnectedness between kusal and ping? And why it's not enough to just do merits, just keep doing merits. That's why coming to these sermons is also very useful. It's essential. Because you need the Dhamma, ladies and gentlemen. Otherwise, you can spend a lot of time doing merits. A lot of time. Because my purpose by encouraging you to do merits, it's not to just keep you addicted or get you addicted to just keep doing merits. There's no point in doing that. There comes a point where you're exhausted. You know, I'm exhausted by doing merits. Because I don't want to just hang around and keep doing merits every day, all day for the rest of my life. I want to do enough merits so that I don't have to do merits again. Does that make sense? I just want to do enough merit so that I don't have to do merits again. And that can only happen if, what happens? Kusal happens. Understanding the Dhamma. Anicca dukkha anatta. So these two things are complementary. They must go hand in hand. Don't just focus on one. Don't just focus on the other. Why do I say that? Why would I not advise you to simply just listen to the Dhamma, understand the Dhamma, don't worry about merits? Why would I never advise you to do that? Because you need merits to understand the Dhamma. I think I proved it to you some time ago. Well, I'll prove it to you again, in case you can't forget. You can always forget, can't remember. See, what is listening to the Dhamma? What is the Dhamma after all? When your chitta arises, a chitta with a Dhamma, so anicca dukkha anatta, let's assume I'm in generalized form, we call it the Dhamma. So this is a chitta with the Dhamma. Okay? Basically, you've heard something. This is sound. Not sound, but vibrations. That's triggered sound. You know, this comes from the karmic strand. Yeah? To hear that sound requires one quantity of energy from your karmic strand. Yeah? So when that sound reaches your... when a chitta is born with that sound, soon after that, another chitta is born to process what it's heard. So actually, I can't give you the Dhamma. I can only make vibrations. The Dhamma is born in your mind. But I can give you words that make sense to you. So using words that make sense to you, I'm trying to transfer a meaning that I have, which has to arise within you. So, you see, anicca, dukkha and anatta are simply three words. And you've heard these words before. Here may not be the first place where you heard these words. You'd heard these words before, but without any meaning to it, no context to it. It had no significance to you. So much so that you just kept calling them anicca, dukkha and anatma. But I had to explain to you that it's not anicca, dukkha, anatma, it's anicca, dukkha, anatta. And for what reason? We took the time to understand that. But you've heard these words before. You might have read them before, right? Because you understand how to pronounce these words. That's all okay. But the meaning of what they are, what these words represent, that has to arise in your mind with help from a teacher. But let's not forget that I can't transfer that meaning to you. That meaning has to arise in your own mind, right? It's like when I say, I love you. How much you felt that depends on how you perceived it. So I could love you from the bottom of my heart, but my words can't convey that to you. Whatever degree to which you give meaning to words like bottom of my heart, love, right, and expressions, whatever extent you give meaning to that, that is the effect that it will have on you when I express them on my side. So you understand that the feeling of love, the intensity of love cannot be communicated over this medium. That has to be born within you. The same is true for the Dhamma. So I can only make vibrations. Sound happens in your mind, and what happens immediately after is your mind tries to make sense of what those sounds are. That's how we make words up. That's how you know how to break the words of this sentence. Because actually I'm not breaking up any words, I'm just making one long sound. Aren't I? See, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P. How did you split them up into A, B, C, D, E? But if I spoke in a different language, then you may not be able to distinguish what those letters are. So that distinguishing happens where? That happens with you, not here. Does that make sense? Right. So the same is true about the Dhamma. When I transfer vibrations, you make sounds out of them, and then the next thing the mind does is it stitches these sounds together to try and give it meaning. Now here's what happens. Here's the beautiful thing that happens. When you're trying to make meaning out of these sounds, okay, your karmic strand must have enough merit. Oh, thank you, audience, because I've never expressed this in this particular way. This is the first time for me as well. putting this in these words. You have to have enough merits in your karmic strand that when your mind stitches all these sounds and makes a word out of it, so it makes anicca out of it, and the explanation behind anicca, so I'm trying to put all I can into it, I bring props and I light candles and I bring knives and scissors and all sorts and try to get this idea across to you, right? Whilst you're busy doing that, if there happens a moment where there is one powerful merit, one powerful merit that comes to fruition, this is not going to be a sound or a smell or a taste or a touch or a sight. It's going to be Dhamma. Dhamma that comes into contact with the mind. Because sight comes into contact with eyes, sound with ears, taste with tongue, smell with nose, touch with body, and Dhamma with mind. So, if there is this merit in your karmic strand, that karmic seed is released from your karmic strand at the point you are trying to make sense of what Swaminarayana is saying, and when that comes to fruition, that is the moment where you are lifted from the Prutakjana Bhumi to the Arya Bhumi. This has to be released from your karmic strand. So your first experience of the Dhamma has to come from your karmic strand. You can create the environment here. This environment is created by a number of factors. You have to be attentive. You have to be in the presence of someone who preaches to you, who is at least a sotapanna. Those are all factors that contribute to this environment. But what gives you that realization, that lifting you up, elevating you from prutakjana to sotapanna, that is done by this karmic seed. So how did that get in there? Tooth fairy. How did merits? Merits. That is done by merits. What kind of merits? Feeding the dogs? Especially your dogs? How about feeding the poor? No, they won't work there. Well. For this to happen, this kind of merit to go into your karmic strand, you have to have supported that cause. Remember, what you give is what you get. Not the what, the why is what goes into your karmic strand. If you have supported the cause of Nibbana, then the karmic seed that joins your karmic strand is one that supports the, fill in the blanks, cause of Nibbana. That's a kusala, yes. So the action itself is not a kusala, because this is the first time, you know, you can't do any kusala until you become a sotapanna. Right, let's get that straight. You can't do any kusala until you become a sotapanna. But what you can do is be in the right place to acquire enough knowledge initially, the Dhamma. So he has to learn the Dhamma, where you learn about what anicca is, what dukkha is, what anatta is. Right? These are the meritorious deeds that you do to purify your view. That's why in the 10 meritorious deeds, you have Sammaditti. Not Sammaditti, beg your pardon. What's the last one in there? It's at the tip of my tongue. What is it? No, that's the Noble Eightfold Path. 10 meritorious deeds, do you remember? No, that's again the Noble Eightfold Path. Right? No, we are talking about the Noble Eightfold Path. I am asking about the 10 meritorious deeds. Dittijukam, that's the one. It's called dittiju kamma. Ditti riju kamma. That is what dittiju kamma is. Ditti is what? View. Sorry to do this, but it's the natural reaction. Not view, not this view. Your insight, right? Ditti. Riju. What is riju? Straight. Riju is straight. Kamma is action. So actions that you take to rectify your view are meritorious deeds. Make sense? So you have dana, sila, bhavana, pattidana, pattanumodana, veyyavaccha, apachayana, dhamma desana, dhamma savana, dittijukam. That's the last one. See, dhamma desana is also a meritorious deed. Dhamma savana, listening to the dhamma, is a meritorious deed. But the last one in the list is dittijukam, which is that's the business. You need that. Dittijukam. So, karmas that you do to rectify your view is dittijukam. It doesn't have to be your views. It's views. Remember, there is no you in this game. Yous and I's are just mere conventional constructs that we have to make sense of the world because we look at the world in that way. Right? So, whenever you make any effort to help rectify view, meaning to guide towards sammaditti, those actions are actions that come in the category of the dittiju kamma, which is the 10th meritorious deed. This is making sense so far? Once again, there are 10 meritorious deeds. You may have heard of them. Dasa punya kriya. Dana, sila, bhavana, patidana, patanumodana, veyyavaccha, apachayana, dhamma desana, dhamma savana, dittiju kamma. That's the last one. You must have read it in the Deeds and Results book. The 10 meritorious deeds and the 10 unmeritorious deeds. So, dittijukamma is the last one. What is dittijukamma? Ditti is view. Riju is to rectify, to set correct, to set right. Karma is action. So, actions taken to rectify view is dittijukamma, which come into the category of this meritorious deed. Whose view? Whose view? There's no who in this game. Views, that's it. Mind's views. It's not a who that has a view, it's a mind that has a view, right? People don't have drushtis, minds have drushtis. Yeah, agreed? Because you are body and mind. Does your body have views? No. That's why your body is always receptive to whatever your mind wishes to do with it. It's the mind that has views. So any actions taken to rectify view becomes a punya kriya, a meritorious deed that adds merit to the karmic strand. Because whose doesn't matter, whatever actions you take to rectify view goes into this karmic strand as good karma. That's why I say, whatever actions you take to help rectify view, such as, what did the gentleman do when he brought this offering? What did he do? He made a request. To do what? Please deliver the Dhamma and deliver us from sansara to help us out of suffering. So, what sort of karma was that? A request made to rectify views. That doesn't matter. Whose is irrelevant here? Views. Because we are all here with some sort of wrong views, bad views, right? Crooked views. Therefore, the request is made to rectify those views, riju, to make them right. Therefore, that is a meritorious deed that goes into the merit in the karmic strand as a dittiju kamma karma. So you invite Swami Nuhanse to deliver a sermon. You set the place up for a sermon. Any actions that you take with the intention of rectifying view That's the way I want you to understand this. And this is, it is how it is, folks. Any actions you take, whether they are verbal, physical, or mental, right? So you see, one thing we can do, now when we do the Devaradhana, which we didn't do today, my bad. When we do the Devaradhana, what is it we are doing? We are inviting. Inviting them for what? Saddhamma munirajasya sunantu saggamokkada. Come here, join us, and listen to this sermon, which is the teaching of the Buddha, so that you may be free from suffering. Is it not an invitation to rectify views? Whose views? That's a forbidden question. Because it doesn't matter whose views. It's irrelevant here, because there is no who anyway. All there are minds and bodies. Yeah. So when you invite someone to come to the sermon, when you encourage someone to come to the sermon, when you give them a seat, when you give them a bottle of water, when you help them settle in, make them feel comfortable, make them feel at home, this community feeling that you create in and amongst each other, all of those things has a part to play in dittiju karma. So all those karmas, ladies and gentlemen, they go to your karmic strand as karmic seeds that will be ready to mature when the right environment is ready. And what is that environment? For that, there are a number of factors. You have to be in the right place with a teacher who is at least a sotapanna or above. You have to be contemplating the Dhamma. You have to be attentive. And when these factors combine, now you're hearing things, right? You're listening to the Dhamma. Listening to the Dhamma is not this karma. That's just sound. So these will be some other karmas, vipakas. But there comes a point where after the mind has heard a sound, the next thing it does is what? Tries to interpret that sound. Yeah? Do you understand what I mean by that? How do you know that this is me clapping? Because you didn't hear a clap. You heard a sound. But you're using your eyes and the sound and you're stitching all this together. And you interpret it as a clap. You understand the difference. So when I say apple, I didn't say the feeling that came to your mind. I just put out some vibrations. In your mind, you stitched all those sounds together. This is all a mental process. And then the picture of an apple or the mental image of an apple comes. I didn't give that to you, did I? I just gave a sound. But in your mind now there's an apple. See, that's all vipaka driven. The same thing happens here. As you listen to the Dhamma, you hear sounds. To hear sounds, it's not this vipaka that you need. But the next moment when the mind stitches all this together. So it's heard anicca, it's heard dukkha, it's heard anatta and the explanation behind it. And now it's trying to make sense of it at that moment. At that beautiful moment. If this vipaka has the right environment to come to fruition, it is released from your karmic strand and comes to fruition. And if that wonderful moment happens, when that wonderful moment happens in your life, you are elevated from the state of a putakjana to a sotapanna. So how did that get in there? By merit. It's a Dhamma, yes. Yeah. This can only give rise to Dhamma Rupa. So this is not a Sabda Rupa, Rasa Rupa, Gandha Rupa, Potabba Rupa, Rupa Rupa. It's none of those. Remember we drew this Rupa Vedana Sanya Sankara Vinyana? Yeah? Yeah? Remember this? And remember the mind? I've explained to you that the Chitta is this process, taking one of these and then processing it. Yeah? So many of these will have gone to process sound, Sabda Rupa. Many of these will have gone. But there comes a point when the mind takes a break, it stitches all those sounds together and then tries to make sense of it. It does it, you know, without you thinking. It just happens. Every moment it does that. Every so often it does that. Yeah? So at one of these moments, this karmic seed comes as a rupa. When that karmic seed comes as a rupa, now it starts to process anicca dukkha anatta, but with this rupa, with this vipaka in the process. And as a result of that, this chitta does what? This is what we call a gotrabhu chitta. In other words, what it means is it changes your, what is gotra? Yes, it breaks your connection with that which is mundane. It elevates you from mundaneness to supramundaneness. This is that chitta that does that. And that chitta has an effect on the mind. So the mind goes from being a putakjana to an arya. And once that is done, it never goes back again. It's a one-way street. Once you become a sotapanna, there's no going back. So be careful before you decide to become one. Because you lose your citizenship of the four great hells. You have to surrender your citizenship. It's not your visa, it's your citizenship. Coming to the heavenly abodes and the human realm is getting a visa. Citizenship is where? In the four great hells. So when you do this, you surrender your citizenship. And you get a new citizenship in the blissful plane. So from that point onwards, you can't go any south of the human plane. See, that is why this vipaka is very important. Once again, how do you get that? Dittijukamma. How does that happen? By helping the cause of dittijju. That's how. Isn't that what you have been doing ever since you have been helping and supporting the sasana? This is why I always say, don't worry about what you put into my alms bowl. Support the mission. That's why I'm banging on about it. Because I want you to earn these dittijukamma vipakas. This is where you'll find your salvation. Don't help us build a granary. Support the mission. Because if you help us build a granary, you will find a granary one day in your backyard. Maybe you will be born in some Tusita Divyaloka or something, and there'll be a granary in your backyard. You wonder, what am I going to do with this? So don't help us build a granary. Let's call it a granary, because otherwise we don't know what the heck we're doing. But in your intention should be much more than that. It should be to support the mission of what? Dittijju kam. Dittijju. Dittiriju. Right view. That is what your mission should be. So when you offer alms to the Swaminvahanses, today you'll have 3 Swaminvahanses and 2 Anagarika Mahathas to offer it to. Oh no, today you're not going to do that. So no Dittijju kam today for you. When you do it, whenever you do it, right? It's not the rice, it's not the dal, it's not the gravy, it's not the potatoes, it's not the fruits, it's not the chocolate, it's not the whatever. I really don't care what goes in there. I care what goes up here. What goes in there, let's not worry about. But let's worry about what goes up here. You know what this ticket is? It says, admit one to Nibbana. That is what this says. It says, admit one to Nibbana. You need that, ladies and gentlemen. Therefore, you know, when you do an alms offering, either at the temple or at your home, always have the mission in mind. And don't even do it to one Swaminvahanse. Even if you have some Swaminvahanse in mind, ask yourself, what is the purpose behind this, behind my supporting this Swaminvahanse? Why do I care about this Swaminvahanse? Why am I devoted to this Swaminvahanse? Take Guru Hamdra for example. Why do you admire, why do you dote on Guru Hamdra so much? Because he's Guru Hamdra, right? He's Guru Hamdra. Meaning he represents liberation. He's there for Nibbana. He's there to guide us to Nibbana. That's why you admire him and you respect him so much. In any other context, it would not be the same. Because he used to live a lay life. You never did what you do today to him back then. Because back then he didn't represent the mission or the sasana. So when you offer something to the Buddha, again, should the Buddha eat it or not? Don't worry about that. Others people come and ask you, what's the point of offering Buddha puja? The Buddha doesn't eat it. Why should we just throw food unnecessarily? No, that's not the point. What you give goes to Namagotha. Why you give goes to your karmic strand. That's the point. So it doesn't have to be a full bowl. It doesn't have to be. But I'm not suggesting that you give an eighth of a bowl either. Because then you're stingy. Because then the thought that goes through your mind is stinginess. And why that much? Shouldn't give that much. Should only give a little. See, the amount you give goes to Namagotha, but those thoughts about why should I give so much? Though that's too much. That's too much. That's what goes to your karmic strand. So whenever that vipaka comes back to you, oh no, that's too much. So it will deprive you of something. You know, in this parahara, the parahara that we do, the candy parahara and all these paraharas, there's a thing called the sesata, if you've seen. It looks like this, right? It's like this, but much bigger than this. Sesata. This sesata is a beautiful Sinhalese word, which means everything. All of one's belongings. That's what sesata means. You know, the Sinhalese expression is sesata madunna. Means literally everything. It's a symbol. It's a symbol of the sasana. That's why they carry them. The murayuda is a different symbol. One of these days we'll talk about what they are. I'm not only talking about this because it's just come into our conversation. The sesata is a symbol. These are not just, you know, shall we say, a ceremonial, ornamentally. You know, it's not just for that. It's not just for show. Each of these things have meaning. The drums, they have meaning. The way they walk, they have meaning. Each of these things have meaning because this is our Sihala tradition. Our ancestors, they didn't do things just for the sake of doing it. Everything had a meaning. We just have to uncover them again because it's lost in the sands of time. So the sesata is a symbol that the sasana, when you do a parahara, it is an invitation. It is an invitation that teaches people that the sasana is somewhere you give your sesata. You give your everything to the sasana. You must ask the question, why though? We don't just do things. Why give everything to the sasana? Typically, where you see the sesata, immediately after that is you see the procession of monks. In the parahara, you see the sesata and immediately afterwards you see a procession of monks. Who are monks? Who are monks? Those who have given their sesata to the sasana, meaning their everything, including their lives. Once you've given your life, what else is there? What else is left to give? Yeah? So that's why they carry the sesata before the Swami Mahan says. What it says is, behind this sesata, behind this item, stands a procession of individuals who have given their everything to the sasana and as a result have got everything from the sasana. What you give is what you get. Sesata from the sasana is nibbana. Because once you've got nibbana, ladies and gentlemen, what else is there left? What else do you need? Once you are enlightened, what else do you need? Once you're enlightened, you own the whole universe. Because you become part of the universe. You acknowledge that you become part of the universe. So that is what the sesata represents. That's why I say, whenever you give something, in whatever quantity it is, in whatever context it is, make an attempt, make an effort to try and make it your sesata. I'm not suggesting here that you should give everything you own and be left homeless and naked in the middle of the street. Please don't do that. That's not what I'm suggesting here. But what I'm suggesting is, if you have just opened up your lunch, right, and you're just sitting down for lunch, and you see there's someone hungry, typically what we do is we say, hey, yeah, come and take half. That's the typical response, right? Here's how I would do it. Here, have it. Let them offer half of that back to you. Because then you have given your sesata. In that context, you don't have to give them your shirt. In that context, you have given them your sesata. They'll be quite surprised as to why you've given them your entire meal. They might even ask you, Mashan, why? Aren't you going to have some? Well, of course, I've given you my meal. If you like, you're welcome to share half of that with me. See, what are you doing then? You're encouraging them to do what? Do some merits. See, you've not just fed the hungry, right? You haven't just fed the hungry. Remember we talked about this a little while ago? When there's a famine, the authorities get together, they take from those who have, and they go and give to those who don't. But they will forever be those who don't have. Because what they do is they always take. Those who give, keep on giving. Those who take, keep on taking. Therefore, the poor will always be poor. The rich will always be rich. But when you give your sesata, and then you encourage that individual to share part of their lunch with you, you've just started them off on the path to abundance. Because it is now them who do the merit. It's now they who do the merit. So you haven't just given them a meal, you've given them dittiju. You've given them right view. So, see, you give the alms, dana, that's one of the meritorious deed, it goes to your karmic strand. But then you give them a lesson in Dhamma to rectify their view about giving. Where does that go? That also goes to your karmic strand. So when it's time for it to come to fruition, they will both come to fruition. Then you will get your meals as well as the Dhamma. Aren't you looking at someone who has both? How did that happen? I am not a miracle. I am not a magician. I am not a wizard. I'm just a very normal, a very average human being who understands how the universe works. Therefore, the universe always favors by me. I have made friends with the universe, ladies and gentlemen. I have made friends with God. God is my friend. God is my friend because He has taught me how He thinks. I am friends with the universe because now I understand how the universe works. The universe always favors with those who understand how the universe works. Therefore, whenever you can, give your sesata. In whatever context, teach your children. They're playing in the playground with their toys. You have two of something. Typically we say, Putta, share it with your friends. We say what? Share it with your friends. What does sharing mean? You keep one part of it, give the other part to the friend, right? If I was a parent, that's not what I would say. I say, give it to your friend, Putta. Give the sesata to your friend. And then I will talk to his friend, my child's friend. I will talk to the child's friend. Say, Putta, see how good your friend is. Why don't you let him have half of it? Now that he's received the whole thing, of course he's going to be inclined to do that because now he sees a very generous friend, doesn't he? Therefore, he's going to be more than inclined to give half of what he has. Now, you see, one person has given the sesata, the other person has given half of the sesata. At least they've started. This is how I want you to think. I always say, if you only have one pencil, don't break it in half and give one half to the other person. Give the whole pencil. And then ask them, may I have half, please? That's what you should do. Ask them to give you half. They'll be surprised. But it's your pencil. No, it's not my pencil, it's your pencil. If you would be so kind to give me half, that person's going to love you to bits. Now, do you need to read another book on how to influence and influence people? You don't have to win friends, ladies and gentlemen. You just be a friend. Then friends will be won. You don't have to go winning friends. You don't have to manipulate. You just be genuine. Just be a genuine person. Be genuinely good. Don't be good for something or for someone or for some purpose. Just be genuinely good. Because once you understand how the universe works, why shouldn't you? Because whatever good you do is also good you do to yourself. Isn't it? Right, before we conclude, I have two things. One is I have a video to show you. But I also have a little note that arrived at the monastery, and Guru Hamdra shared this with everyone in the audience 2 weeks ago. But I thought I should bring you a translation of it as well. So we have this group who has been working very closely with the monastery, very devoted group of people. They call themselves the Sahalpiyavuru. I think there are members here as well in this audience. They're not only Piyavuru, they are Mauvaru as well. But they call themselves fathers. I don't know how to translate this to English. Sahalpiyavuru. Rice fathers. So these are a group of people who have made it their ambition and purpose to provide rice to the monastery to whatever extent they can. I don't think they expected that the monastery would need so much when they first started, but they have been going strong. And it's a growing community. People are coming together. So it's not one individual. I don't think one individual can do it, but collectively, it has been made possible. So 2 weeks ago, they'd sent in a letter addressed to Guru Hamdra, and I got a translation of it. If you please, I can read it to you. Therwan Sarnai, the great meritorious act of donating rice to the Sambuddha Sasana, says Guru Hamdra Ne, it has been a year since we started this great, noble, meritorious deed. Throughout this past year, we were able to offer, wait for it, 120,000 kilograms, that's 120 tons of rice, to the noble Mahasangha. We were able to offer 750,000 meals to the Mahasangha. Guru Hamdra Ne, the value of our great meritorious deed over this year alone is worth more than 30 million rupees. So if this is what we would have had to spend, me? No, you. This is what we would have had to spend if we'd bought it from the shop, but didn't have to, because there are those who want to support the mission. Did you come? That's all I can say. Did you come? They're not only filling stomachs, but they're also filling hearts, because they do it with the right purpose in mind. May our deepest reverence be offered to the noble Mahasangha for granting us this meritorious opportunity to perform this great deed in the Sambuddha Sasana. May this lead to the supreme bliss of Nibbana, and may the Triple Gem bless you. So this was a letter that was sent in by the Rice Fathers Association, of which I know there are members in this community as well, in this audience. But this is a collective thing that we are doing here. We are all part and parcel of this. There are, like I've said in the past, ladies and gentlemen, it's not the quantity. It's the sesata. For some, sesata will be just this. That's all they'll have. For others, it'll be this and this. For others, it'll be the whole thing. Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter what you give. What matters is why you give it. And the intention behind your giving. Because that is what joins your karmic strands. You need these vipakas to ripen, ladies and gentlemen, for you to keep lifting yourselves up from prutakjana to sotapanna, sotapanna to sakrudagami, sakrudagami to anagami. All of these are vipakas from your karmic strand. If becoming a sotapanna is this, then becoming sakrudagami must be what? The same. It's another karmic seed from your karmic strand. That could happen while you're meditating. Because only becoming a sotapanna is dependent on you listening to the Dhamma. From there on, you don't have to be in an audience. You can be contemplating, maybe sweeping the floor, washing your clothes, cooking in the kitchen, contemplating. But at some moment, one vipaka comes loose and comes to fruition. That is the vipaka that lifts you up from one noble achievement to the next. And it happens once, twice, thrice, and four times. The fourth time is the last time it needs to happen, and that is the time you become an arahatunvansa. After that, you're done. Then you don't need any moping. After that, you're done. No sooner than your body gives up, your journey is complete. But that is why they are doing this. They understand it, because they've been listening to the Dhamma. See, all of this is for freedom. We are freedom fighters. We all are. I'm a freedom fighter. That's why I've given my sesata, can't you see? I gave my wife to the sasana. I gave my home to the sasana. I gave whatever I'd earned to the sasana. Then finally I gave my life to the sasana. Now I give my time to the sasana. I've got nothing left to give to the sasana. I've given everything to the sasana. All that's left is the breath that I take in and whatever energy I take in from my food. All of that is given to the sasana. That is how I have given my sesata to the sasana. You do what you can. That's why I have created this opportunity, this granary thing that we are doing, to feed anyone and everyone who comes in through those gates, who needs their mouths to be fed, so that they can then go on to listen to the Dhamma and practice, and so that free themselves from suffering. That is the whole purpose behind that. Never confine it to one thing, one person, one monastery. Don't even think that you are giving to Jetonaram Monastery. Don't confine yourself to that. In vain, don't do that. Always have the mission in mind. Who's the head of the mission? Venerable Guru Theru. Who's the head of the mission? The Buddha is the head of the mission. We are only little pawns in the game, that's all. The Buddha is the head of this mission. Right, I have a video to show you. This is the Vesak Pinkama that we had at the monastery last week. There were many of you there. And I have a short video to show you of the collective merit making that we all did. So please rejoice. And when I say rejoice, what I ask you to do is to earn more merits just by watching it. If you were there, then you will have memories of it. If you weren't there, that's still okay because someone earned those merits and you can do again by rejoicing in them. Let me do you a favor and translate that last part into words that you understand. The Buddha speaks to a king and he says, "Oh mighty king, I am the king. I am the king of the Dhamma. I am Dhamma Raja. The Dhamma is my kingdom, and I am the king of that kingdom. I have turned the wheel of the Dhamma. It is now set in motion, and it cannot be stopped. It cannot be unturned. This is an invitation, ladies and gentlemen. The Buddha gives us assurance. The Buddha speaks to our heart and he says, I have now established the kingdom. The king is on his throne. Come to me, subjects, disciples who wish to find their freedom. For the wheel of Dhamma has now been set in motion and it cannot be stopped by any deva, by any mara, or by anyone for that matter. What more reassurance do you need? Don't these sermons convince you that the wheel of Dhamma has been set in motion? Aren't the truths coming to light? Isn't life's riddles being explained and set right in front of your very eyes? These sermons are not pre-prepared. I don't have a script. So it must be either magic or it must be the truth itself. Because you don't have to come prepared to preach the truth. Isn't that right? You don't have to come prepared to speak the truth. But if I had to tell you a lie, I'd have to prepare for it. I'd have to make sure that everything matches with everything else and the story makes sense. But I don't have to come prepared. I seek permission from the Buddha. And when I get up on my feet, I feel confident that from henceforth, the truth will be spoken. That is how you listen to all this. That's how all this comes to light. So, come on. The Buddha is still on his throne. The kingdom of Dhamma still awaits with its doors wide open for you to come in, become its subjects. It's heaven. Liberate yourselves. Free yourselves. Let's leave it there. Okay. Let's take a moment then to transfer all the merits that we have acquired today. First and foremost, let us transfer these merits to the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasakas and upasikas, who have since time immemorial protected and preserved the sublime teachings of the Buddha and passed it down through generations of the noble lineage in the form of the Tripitaka, which is thankfully available to us today to study, understand and comprehend the Dhamma. Let us take a moment to transfer these merits to the Mahanayaka Theras, the Anunayaka Theras of all the chapters, as well as the monks and nuns resident in your local temples and nunneries who have always been by your side through thick and thin, come rain or shine. Let us also transfer this merits to my teacher, Guru Swami Mahanse, as well as all the monks resident in the monastery and the Anagarikas and Anagarikas attached to the monastery. Let us also take this moment to transfer these merits to our devotees and friends of the monastery, who, for the sake of their merits to help them attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana, continue to sustain the Mahasangha. This includes all of you who provide the Mahasangha with shelter, arms, robes and medicines, as well as provide their know-how and continue to extend their well wishes. May they all rejoice in these merits and by the power of these merits. May they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also transfer this message to our mothers and fathers, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, nephews and nieces, our friends, our acquaintances, our teachers, our employers and our employees, as well as anyone and everyone who've helped us, supported us, and assisted us in many ways and shapes and forms. May these spirits help them to be free of suffering, be free of any physical and mental ailments, and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May by the power of these merits they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also transfer these merits to the Devas and Brahmas, spirits and demons, primarily the Sakadeva, as well as all the numerous gods and deities who have committed themselves to fulfill and preserve the Sambuddha Sasana. Let us transfer these merits to our guardian deities who keep a watchful eye over us and keep us out of harm's way. May they prosper in divine power and wisdom. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also transfer these merits to our forefathers, our ancestors, those who passed away in our names, reminding ourselves that it is in their blood, sweat and tears today we are able to enjoy the comforts of life as we do. Let us also transfer these merits to members of the armed forces as well as the police force, who sacrificed their lives to protect the peace and harmony of our nation. Let us also transfer these merits to those who lost their lives in the wars, be their friend or foe, as well as those who lost their lives to natural disasters and calamities such as tsunamis and earthquakes, landslides, fires, floods, pandemics and so on. Reminding ourselves that in this infinitely long journey of samsara, they will all have been parents to us, friends to us, siblings to us, with an abundance of compassion and loving kindness and a sense of gratitude for all that they have done for us. Let us transfer these merits to them. By the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in the woeful planes, may they redeem themselves and be born in the blissful plane. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, may by the power and blessings of all the merits we have acquired throughout the day, we be able to witness the advent of many hundreds of thousands of arahants on this blessed land. And finally, may you and I and everyone who's helped make this program a success become a Rahatan Mahanse or an Arahatteranin Mahanse in this very life itself and in the era of this Sri Sambuddha Sasana itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. The Mahasangha will now transfer their blessings to you. Raga kinnen nidetnva Dvesha kinnen nidetnva Moha kinnen nidetnva Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravetva Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravetva Mamada siyalu loka siyalu satvayo Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetva Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetva Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravetva Raga gini niveva Dvesha gini niveva Moha gini niveva Nivan sapala deva nivan sapala deva nivan sapala deva tunurvange suvisi ananta maha guna belen sielu loka sielu sattvayama nibbana parama sukhen sukhita taravetva sadhu sadhu sadhu.